This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everybody. How lovely to see so many familiar faces. It's lovely that so many people are coming to the whole series as opposed to one-off lectures. And I'll admit that was one of the hopes we had for this series. Well, my name's Heidi, and I'm part of the events team here at the museum. It's my pleasure to welcome you today. As you all know, these series of talks are linked to our Not Just Ned exhibition. And the exhibition has been a lovely opportunity for us to link to the communities in Canberra and around the nation and around the world. So we've made beautiful connections with the Irish community in Canberra and Australia. We've made great connections with the family history groups. And it's just been nice to engage with the community in this way. Our Not Just Ned exhibition has far exceeded our expectations in the visitor numbers, and we're really thrilled that you've enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed putting the darn thing together. Today I'm really pleased to present Dr. Perry McIntyre. Perry's been involved in Irish history and genealogy since the late 1970s, and she has professional qualifications in history. Her PhD on convict family reunions was published by the Irish Academic Press in late 2010. She served on the History Council of New South Wales and was the president in 2005 and 2006. She was a councillor of the Australian Society of Genealogists for 20 years and has also served as a councillor on the Royal Australian Historical Society and the Australian Catholic Historical Society, and is a current member of the Great Irish Famine Commemoration Committee. Goodness, how do you find the time, Perry? She's published and spoken extensively on immigration, particularly the 19th century Irish. She has led or co-led 9 successful tours to Ireland and currently works at St John's College at the University of Sydney. She will also be one of the speakers at the conference on the weekend. So, I would like you to please join me in welcoming Dr. Perry McIntyre.
Thanks very much, Heidi. I'll get straight into it because this talk could go on. Although I'm very much Australian-born, I've embraced things Irish to the extent where I have very great deal of difficulty in stopping talking. So, thanks, Heidi. Heidi and I met for the first time about an hour ago in the foyer, but we have been firm email friends for about the last 2 months because I've been helping Dr. Richard Reed, a friend of many of you in Canberra, with the abstracts and biographies. And I'll tell you, as genealogists, it's easy. Trying to get historians to write a paragraph about themselves or a concise note about what they're saying has been a difficult situation. But we've done it. So today what I want to do is talk about Irish immigrants. Some of you, and I might have a show of hands, may have just started or thinking of starting doing your family history. Who would consider yourself beginners? Others like me and Barbara Moore and Trish Downs, just because I know them, and many of the rest of you have been at it for many years, at it for so long that we started our family histories when there were no birth, death and marriage indexes in New South Wales, even on microfiche. Think about that. So what that does for most of us that do genealogy, and then many of us become professional historians or academic historians or whatever you like, but I consider that you are all historians. Anyone who writes history is a historian. Not necessarily a good one, but a historian. So what we know from genealogy are the sources. Today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about sources, a little bit about Irish immigration in general, and give you a quick romp about the place. And at the end I will wheel out something quite exciting for question time. I believe we've got till about 1:30. If anyone feels the need to go to the loos or depart, do so. It will not worry me in the slightest if you get up, move around, shake your legs or whatever. So it won't distract me. So, Irish immigration. There are many images of the Irish leaving home, both here in Australia, the National museum here has some extremely good artwork of immigration, not just from Ireland but other places, the leaving of home, if you like. And I think it's also been a theme in some of the exhibitions here and in various places around Canberra and the countryside. So this is one of the sort of well-known leaving of home images, where you've got the parish priest, the general people standing around, some of them are crying, there's children playing in the dirt, and that kind of leaving home. They're all loading onto the wagon, the horse-drawn cart, to go somewhere, to depart Ireland. The house in the background is reasonably substantial in this case. It's got a roof and a chimney. This is part of a series of the London Illustrated News, 1851, 10th of May, 1851. Many of these images are now online, but those of you who live here in Canberra are extremely fortunate that you're able to go to the National Library and some of these, this material, read the full transcripts of the newspapers, of the articles around these images, because the images, like many indexes, are just the thin end of the wedge of getting into more detail about your immigrants. So I'm talking New South Wales, there being no Canberra, ACT, in the 19th century, and many of the other states were not created then. So we're talking about how they came. The first lot of Irish immigrants were, of course, the convicts and the military who came with them. I'm not necessarily going to talk about those today, but you just need to be aware of them. The huge chain migration that links your earlier immigrants, either free, unassisted or convict, with subsequent generations is particularly strong in the Irish. There were a great percentage of convicts transported from Ireland from Munster, from the province of Munster. And in Richard Reid's PhD, which has just recently been published by Anchor Books Australia and is available here for sale, he states that a great number of the assisted immigrants that came from Ireland in the period he examined between 1848 and 1870 were also Munster. And it's our suspicion as historians that some of those statistics relate to the family linkages, although often they're not proven unless you guys who do your family history can prove them, and sometimes you can. So then we're going to look a little bit at free immigrant records to the Australian colonies from England and Ireland in particular. I want to talk very briefly about what was assisted immigration, and it's fairly obvious what assisted is. They were helped in some way, almost entirely in the case of Australia, by the colonial government. The imperial or British government only helped the famine orphan girls in numbers. The girls who came between 1848 and 1850 on those ships from workhouses in Ireland, sailing out of Plymouth but from the workhouses, were paid for by the British government. So how did it work, and what was happening in Ireland, and why did people leave and how? You've always got to think about why they left and how they left. So the push, what we call in history, the push and pull factors. But the basic thing you need to understand is your records. And as I mentioned before, when and why were records created? You are not going to find a baptism in Queensland before December 1859, because there is no such place. You might find people who are living in Moreton Bay, as Brisbane was then known, who were baptised, born, whatever, in the colony of Moreton Bay, but it is part of New South Wales. So you might need to look at both Queensland records, as they've since become, and New South Wales, and subsequently. Tasmania, or Van Diemen's Land as we know it, was run separately from when convicts first started to arrive there, about 1803. And not many Irish convicts were transported. I'm talking in general here, in fact very few, to Tasmania until after transportation stopped in New South Wales in 1840, we say. However, there was a little scheme where men only were transported from England, Ireland and Scotland to an extent in 1848 and 50, and they are commonly called exiles. Some of those came also to Queensland, who claim never to have had convicts, but if you left home under a sentence of transportation, I would say you were called a convict, would you not? Even if you got your ticket of leave or pardon immediately upon arrival. And those men were brought out as labourers. As bizarre as it may seem, more men were wanted in the colony by that period to help with building the infrastructure. So you need to understand why records were created. I'm going to do a little, very little bit of basic research how-to here, because I think it's important. Even those who have been doing genealogy for a lot of years, sometimes it pays to go back and have a look at material that you may have got years and years ago, because most of us in this audience are over 21 and people think we're getting demented. We are not, actually. We are getting smarter. Every day we get smarter because we get more experienced. And you might look at a record that you bought from, say, birth, deaths and marriages in the 1980s and think, I now know what that means. I know what that column is telling me. And I'm sure many of you had that experience. So your essential first steps for finding any immigrant, but your Irish in particular, because the situation with records back there may be a little more difficult for all manner of reasons, is you need to do your homework here. Many of you, and myself included, have been back to Ireland with material, say a shipping record and a death certificate, and say you might go to a county and say, look, I've got this material about my ancestor from, say, County Clare, and I know they're from this parish, and I know they're from this townland, and they left in this particular date. What more can you tell me? And they look at you kind of blankly and say, well, you're telling me more than we know here. You know, you've got fantastic stuff. What more could you possibly know? You can stand on the spot from your Australian records. So I'm going to show you a couple of my own family because I always think that that's a more legitimate way to go. This was my most recent first arrival, my mother's grandfather, Matthew Michael McGlynn, who from this death certificate you can see he was 37 years in New South Wales in the how long in the colonies column, and he was from Drumsnagh in County Roscommon. That makes it almost precisely 1879, but I couldn't find him arriving despite looking through lists and lists for many years, and I'll reveal the secret of how I found him at the end. But this is a beautiful, typical death certificate. It tells you where, how old he was, what he died of. But if you look at a name, occupation of father, a name and maiden name of mother, McGlynn, of course, his surname's McGlynn. He's a man. Yes, his father's probably named McGlynn. But the informant, who happens to be his son, knew nothing else, his Australian-born son. But he does know where he's from in Ireland, and he does know, you know, when he married, his wife's name, etc. The all-important thing being Drumsnagh, County Roscommon. So the death certificate of your first arrival. And, of course, the marriage certificate tells you a lot more often. Not in this case. Father's name, mother's name and surname, father's occupation, blank. Birthplace, not given. So what did I do? Of course you do what we all do. We went to the parks, Catholic Church parish registers, which don't survive for 1883. So his marriage certificate is not informative as far as finding out about where he and indeed his English-born wife are from. They had five children, and in true style, I decided I'd get all five certificates. So I started with the two oldest, and that didn't help me particularly. So I went to the youngest one, and that didn't help me, and worked my way back to the middle. It was the middle child, of course, the last of the five certificates I got that actually helped. But that's the way of it. So here's a birth of a child in 1888, and it's quite useful. He's the informant. All the way through, he's the informant, which is great about him. He's a carpenter, and he's from Alphin. When I first got this certificate in 1990, which is frighteningly long after I started doing family history work in the late 70s, I should have got it a long time ago, I couldn't work out a place called Alphin. I tried my damnedest. Eventually, when I got to know Ireland and Roscommon-Leitrim border area, which is where he's from, it turns out that it's a diocesan or parish name, Elphin, E-E-P-H-L-I-N, which is very screamingly apparent once you know. And just the birth of another child, not giving a terrible lot of information, except that by the time this child's born in 1902, the youngest one, he's a storekeeper. And he's 54 and from Roscommon. So just the basic stuff. You must do it. In New South Wales, there are transcription agents you can apply through to get transcripts of certificates. All three, I think, are working at the moment are very good, but I strongly recommend that you get these original copies yourself because you are then able to interpret the information as you get smarter. Irish immigration pre-famine, the famine of 1845. The colony of New South Wales, just a few stats for you. In 1820, 54% of the population of New South Wales was free. So that's still right in the middle of convict transportation. But many of them are, of course, colonial born by then, and there are also some free immigrants paying their way, getting here in all other means, and there is also an early assisted immigration scheme to do with wives and families of convicts, which is what I did my thesis on, where men who were married before they left England and Ireland could apply once they were at the ticket of leave or probation stage for their families to come out free. And those families came out absolutely free to themselves too, and they came on female convict ships. So they're tricky to find, many of them, because they're not listed on the indent of the convict ship, because they're not convicts, but they are listed in other places. So you get free women and free children coming on those ships as well. By 1830, the total population was 46,000. By 36, 64% of the population of New South Wales was free, and by 1850... on the doorstep of the famine itself in Ireland, the population had reached 256,500. The Irish were particularly keen to take advantage of assisted schemes, and between 1832 and 45, 30,000 Irish had immigrated to Australia. And between 1839 and 45, more than half of the 46,500 immigrants to New South Wales were Irish. Now, that's an overview for that period. If you break that down a bit, you can see, we'll just look at New South Wales at the moment because time will get me towards the end if we don't do this. Between 1821 and 1900, there were a total of 258,000 immigrants to the colony. Of those, roughly just under 200,000 were assisted, or 77%. Into Queensland, it's 86%. Of course, your numbers aren't anything as large, but it's a much larger number. Queensland had its own immigration schemes as well, as did Victoria, and there were lots of little private schemes as well, which we'll mention briefly in a minute. Overall, the total, about 1.5 million, came into the Australian colonies in that period, and half of them were assisted. But this varies in time. And this, as this slide shows you, some years there's no assisted. And immigration in the 1840s had dropped off in Australia just because it was a lull period in assisted immigrants, nothing to do with the famine in Ireland. It just happened to be a period when they were changing systems. What you have to remember is that immigration to Australia was extremely well organised, and that's why we have such brilliant records. The poor old Americans don't have such good records, partly because the distance was greater to Australia, so in order for people to survive the long voyage, they had to have it better organised. They were fed on board the ship. There were surgeons on board most ships. There were schools or a schoolmaster or mistress on board the ship. There were matrons, and it was very well regulated. There are thousands of these kind of documents that vary over time, and as residents of the ACT, you are extremely fortunate to have the National Library sitting there. People like me who live in a major capital city that's not Canberra are also fortunate because we have the microfilm reels of the Australian Joint Copying Project. I'll explain in a minute to those who don't know what that is in a while. So that's the top page of a typical regulation. And you can see the minute detail detailing everything that needs to be done in order to apply. When they got to Sydney, they were interrogated. Who are you? Who are your parents? Where are you from? How old are you? Did anyone help you? And this is an image from the graphic in 1870 where they're being asked these questions when they arrive by the immigration agent. And this is the sort of detail that they provided. Now, I hope at least all of you have at least one assisted immigrant, because this detail is absolutely fabulous. We'll just go across the third grouping, family grouping there, Philip Malone, because it reveals quite a bit of information about the sort of terrific stuff you can find on your immigrant. He's 40, he's a farm labourer, he's from New Ross in County Wexford. His parents are named, both dead. He's Catholic, he could read, and he had an uncle who was at the Williams River. And his wife had an uncle, who was at the Williams River. There was a mount paid of £32.10, RR there in brackets. That's under the remittance regulations, where Mary Malone's uncle paid a proportion of the passage in order to bring that family out, so to assist them out. And as I said, that connection with people who were already here in the colony is extremely strong. There's also a pound there under AI Act, which is the Australian Immigrant Act, which is another system that's working at the time, where they were paid a certain amount of money was helped. The other thing you'll notice in that is the column of their religion and the column whether they could read or write. The top guy you'll know can read, as can his wife Jane. The next one cannot read, Dennis McNamara. His wife, Mary, could both read and write. Dennis is one of the few older people there who can neither read or write, the others being children. Patrick Malone here could neither read or write, but then he was 4 years old. What that is telling you is the level of literacy in the Irish population after the education system came in, national education system came into Ireland in 1835, a system that we in Australia later adopted. So the idea that the Irish were all bog, stupid, couldn't read, couldn't write, and were totally destitute is absolutely wrong. The other thing that these assisted immigrants, and of course the ones that pay for themselves, show is that they were not the destitute poorest of the poor. They had to have a kit of clothing to get on the boat. So they had to be able to afford some clothes. They had to also usually afford to be able to get to the port of departure. And if you were from somewhere like northwest Donegal, you may have been lucky enough to sail out of somewhere like Derry or Belfast. But in the main, the ships that came to Australia sailed from Cork until 1848. And after that, they sailed from Plymouth or Portsmouth. So they had to be able to get across the Irish Sea. All these things you have to think about, and how did they get to the port? This is another one I like to just briefly show you about the Keaton family on the Mangaton. When Paul Keating was the Prime Minister, he was going for a visit to Ireland, and the current ambassador here in Canberra at the time rang the Society of Genealogists and asked us if we could just establish where in County Clare Paul Keating's family were from, so that when he went on his formal official Prime Minister visit, they could take him to the spot. a quick couple of certificates, and we found Heather Garnsey, Keith Johnson and I did this in about a day, that the Keaton family, as they were named, which when they were interrogated on the port, that's the name that was written down by the agent, John Keaton, so it's Keaton, not Keaton. And it's definitely the right family because of the grouping of the, the John and Mary and all their children. And they were from Tynar in Galway, which is a tiny little place in Galway. And there's now a plaque in the cemetery in Tynar where there's lots and lots of Keatings, but we and they couldn't establish from parish registers exactly whether the families buried there were this family. But again, Paul Keating was able to stand on that tiny spot, which is one of those little villages that's basically got a general store and a pub and not much more. So he knows that that's where they're from. So it's always good to show you the spelling. Do not get yourself locked in to how one spells one's name, because even in Ireland now, people will often not be particularly strict about how their names are spelt, particularly maybe in the West. If they're Irish-speaking, it doesn't really matter within a little variation quite how one spells one's name, because you know who you are. The other part of the organisation is this: is there were immigration agents throughout England, Ireland, Scotland, who vetted the immigrants, if you like, at the port, showed them the regulations, made sure that if the regulations at the time said that the men had to be under 30, that they weren't 70. There are some variation in ages. At sometimes the parish priest was not able to ascertain precisely who you are, precisely your age, and there are some variations. And there are a few corruptions, if we say, where someone may have taken on someone else's shipping permission, but it is pretty rare. This guy was involved, was part of a Huguenot family in Cork that now seemed to have died out almost completely. John Bernard being the man's name, spelt Besnard, often in Cork still pronounced as Besnard, and very much involved in the immigration committee and in things going on in Cork. It's an absolutely beautiful image from Rex Nankevill here in the National Library. So I want to read you a little bit of this about the voyage. They often say that the voyage across the Irish Sea was the worst. You may be able to read that, but I'll just read a little bit of it to you. This is part of the Select Committee in 1854, printed in British Parliamentary Papers. Were you ever in a gale of wind? I cannot say that I was, but I have had the unhappiness to come from Cork, this is going across to England, with a large body of immigrants, many of whom had to be put in hospital after arrival. And one man of the name of Ryan from Nina in the county of Tipperary, the father of seven children, died an hour after he landed from cramps produced by the wetting and fatigue he passed through during the night. How many might there have been upon that occasion on the deck? I think the numbers were about 140. This would be a boat about the size of the current Manly Ferry, those of you who have ever been to that other colonial port just up in Sydney. No shelter? Not the slightest. What length was the run? 30-odd hours. What year was that? 1840. 15 years ago, yes. That occurrence terminated my connection with the Bounty immigration from the port of Plymouth. Do such things occur now? I cannot answer that. All I'm prepared to state or prove is that there is no shelter or protection given to Irish immigrants proceeding to English ports. You've heard the evidence of the last witness with reference to the deck passengers. Does your own experience bear that out? Yes, entirely. I've gone to Liverpool expressly to wait the arrival of Irish steamers, and no language in my command can describe the scenes I have witnessed there. The people were positively prostrated and scarcely able to walk after they got out of the steamers. And then they were seized hold of by unprincipled runners so well known in Liverpool. In fact, I consider the manner in which passengers are conveyed from Irish to English ports disgraceful, dangerous, and inhumane. Just a comment there, that's people in Liverpool trying to get money from potential immigrants to go to America. That was not the situation from Liverpool or Portsmouth to Australia. Was that because they were just off a voyage and seasick, or merely because they had been on an upper deck exposed to the weather, prostrated from the inclemency of the weather? And the cold? Yes. And wet through, or anything of that sort? As wet as if they had been dipped in the sea. But the great majority of the passengers shipped in a vessel for a passage from Ireland to England who had never been at sea before would be seasick all the way. Yes, and if you add to that the wetting I described, they would be in a most helpless state. Do you think not the greater part of that would probably be from seasickness? Seasickness must always leave a very debilitated feeling for a long time, and that must be of greatly increased by the suffering from cold at night. And it goes on. These select committees on immigration throughout the 19th century are well worth you getting out and reading. That's just a tiny piece of it. But when you consider that short voyage was 2 days across the Irish, a day and a half across the Irish Sea, after they may well have walked from somewhere to get to Cork to get across the Irish Sea or from Dublin, the beginning of the voyage is possibly the worst for them. However, back to the organisation. This is the government immigrants' mess room. On the left-hand side, we have on the wall, sorry it's such a bad slide, Scottish immigrants, and on the other side, the Irish immigrants. They were divided for messing. But once they were on the boat, such a division was not so strict. On the single female ships, they did try to put girls from the same counties together, so they had some sort of friendship, companionship, if not relationship, on the voyage. And at least a familiarity with accents. And some of your Scots and Irish may well have been only Gaelic speaking or barely English speaking, especially in the early period of 19th century. So how did they get to the port? By the 1840s, there was a reasonably good rail system in Ireland that would bring you around to the major ports of departure. This is the opening of the Mallow Railway Station in County Cork in March 1849. So you can see it's quite a substantial building and a huge crowd of people there about to get on the train. One of the railway stations at Gould Cross in County Tipperary, where many of the immigrants who came out of County Tipperary would have got on the train. This is the railway station as it stands today. It's now a private house. But the building itself, apart from having, you know, windows and doors and someone privately living in it, would have changed little from the mid-19th century when these stations were built. The other way they got to the port of departure was by car. You sometimes see in reports that they went by car or coach. And this is one of Bianconi's cars, so-called. He was an Italian immigrant who started like the Cobb and Co. of Ireland, if you like, and people paid a certain proportion of money to go all over Ireland, but also to ports of departure. So this may well be your immigrant family sitting there. I doubt many of ours may have been wearing the top hats, but nevertheless, a typical family being taken to somewhere. Again, the organisation. As I said, transportation to New South Wales ceased in 1840, but there were convicts in the Hyde Park Barracks in Sydney, now a museum, well worth a visit to when you're in Sydney, until the first shipload of famine orphan girls arrived in Sydney in 1848, when they suddenly thought, hang on, we've got 250 girls, single women here, what are we going to do with them? And they stayed on board the boat for a little while they organised for them to go to the barracks. So the convicts, few convict men that were still there, were quickly moved out and the women were put there. So they were both protected from the prying eyes of the public, and it gave them an opportunity to kind of get their feet, if you like, and it was from there that they were hired out. And there was an agreement, an indenture for up to 3 years, between 1 and 3 years, for them to go and work for someone within the colony. So here you've got the girls milling around at the top, and then at the bottom, two girls hugging, one saying goodbye, Mary, and then signing their agreements. Those agreements, by the way, could be voided when the girls got married. This is a typical agreement that was signed this day between Edward King at a place near Morpeth, Wallalong near Morpeth, between Michael Ryan, admittedly it's a guy, but the women signed these too, from the Ocean Empress, so he's an assisted immigrant. So he's signing up to be a labourer at £30 per annum. Unfortunately, they don't survive for everyone, but they're in the Colonial Secretary's correspondence in the archives in Sydney, in the State Archives, State Records of New South Wales. For you who are driving up from Sydney, Kingswood's the place to go. It's not only closer than Globe Street in Sydney, but it's also where all the original records are stored. Globe Street these days only has microfilm material, so Kingswood's the place to go. And you can order those pre-visit these days. So there are various schemes, as I've kind of mentioned before. So the convicts being considered the first assisted immigrants, roughly 160,000, that varies, but only by 1,000 or two here and there. Approximately a third are Irish. And while I'm talking of convicts and Irish convicts, one of your own, part of whom's in the audience, Peter Mabry and Trish Downs have together done a terrific website of Irish convicts, and it's really very, very good. I never remember its URL, but if you Google Peter Mabry convicts, you get it up very quickly. And Trish has done a lot of the, Trish Downs here, who's in the front row today, has done a lot of the computer work for that. And it's really a marvellous way in. But don't forget to look at the original records yourselves as well, which are housed in State Records New South Wales, but you have available here the convict indents in the National Library on microfilm. So as I mentioned before, there's the wives and families of convicts. That's officially gazetted in 1817, runs through to the end of transportation in New South Wales. And then through the lobbying of Caroline Chisholm to her friend Earl Grey in London, the scheme starts again between 1848 and 1852, and also operates in the other colonies that had transportation, such as Van Diemen's Land and Western Australia. By 1852, the remittance regulations come in, and anyone in the colony could put down a proportion of the fare and help their families out, so they dump these sort of schemes. There's free single women who come to the colony, who are encouraged to come to the colony as domestic servants and marriage partners. Around 3,500 of them come between 1832 and 1836 to New South Wales and Tasmania. About a third of those are Irish. And Dr. Liz Rushen from Melbourne and I have done three books on those girls, published by Anchor Books Australia, which are available for sale in the museum, in the exhibition part of the museum. But we'll see if we can do something about getting them in the normal bookshop as well, so you don't have to pay to go into the museum to buy a book. Seems to me a bit peculiar, but there you go. So we've written about those girls, how the scheme started and how long it went, with some biographies of the women as much as possible. Some of you, at least one or two of you in this audience, will no doubt have a single girl that came under that scheme. Then various families under various regulations at different periods. That sounds glib, but the regulations, like today for immigration, change almost with a breeze, and certainly with the change of politics, both in Australia and in the UK, the schemes changed. So people like the Reverend J.D. Lang had a scheme going. Admittedly, he was trying to get Scots immigrants out to prevent all these horrible Irish coming. And he brought quite a number of Scottish immigrants out. Sydney Herbert's Needlewomen were also English, but I'm just giving you those examples because there were small, privately run schemes the entire 19th century. The Nottingham Lace Makers, and of course Earl Grey's Workhouse Orphan Scheme, the Donegal Relief Scheme, which ran in the late 1850s, people from Donegal, and I'll get to that a little bit in a minute. Children of Bounty Immigrants. There was a bounty immigration scheme where settlers could pay a certain amount of money to get out perhaps agricultural labourers or dairy maids or some form of worker that they particularly wanted for their business, and they paid a bounty or a proportion of money for those people to come. And when the people arrived in Australia and they were interrogated at the port of departure, port of arrival, much like the previous slides of the girls being asked where they came from, if they were deemed suitable, then the money was reimbursed to those settlers from the land fund. And then, as I've mentioned, remittance regulations. South Australian Company was formed. South Australia had its own immigration. And any of you who've got immigrants that go into Queensland, Queensland is quite complicated in a sense because of the huge coastline. They had immigration into Cairns, Maryborough, Moreton Bay, Brisbane, all the way up the coast, different schemes. And some of those records don't survive very well because there was a flood in the archives in 1974, and also other floods have happened and various records have been destroyed in Queensland. So it's not only this the tale about a fire in the forecourts in Ireland, which is apocryphal to a sense because not all the records of Ireland were destroyed in that fire, but all of us have had some form of destruction. And even in these current floods, there have been archives and destroyed or damaged. And I'm sure in Christchurch there was some damage done to the records as well. We can protect our records to an extent, but not from acts of God sometimes. So one of the best books on an overview of immigration, which was written in the 1980s, I think, 82, Helen Woodcock wrote Rites of Passage, is a great book on Queensland immigration. Bishop Quinn, for example, in Queensland chartered a ship called the Erin Gobrae in 1862, which was a black ball vessel. Many of the black ball vessels came into Queensland, and it was one of the nastiest voyages in that period into the east coast of Australia. Took 196 days, including 14 days to cross the Irish Sea, which, from what I've read to you before, would not have been a good start. But remember, almost all of the ships came fairly easily and unharmed. These nasty voyages are the ones that are remembered by, because us human beings like to remember the bad things. I mentioned the Wives and Families of Convicts scheme. How I got into that was I was working as a professional genealogist at the time, years ago, and I kept getting clients who had immigrants come under this scheme, and I discovered these absolutely brilliant applications that the married convict could had to fill in when he applied for his family. So it gives you his name, the ship, the convict ship he arrived on, his sentence. And then he signs it, and I think in many cases it is the man himself's signature, but of course, like all things, it's hard to know whether it's the clerk or whether it's him. And then it's got to be certified by his employer, so you know who he works for, and that this guy had been employed by William Bellamy from June 1824. And then it's countersigned by a clergyman or magistrate. And what I like about this is, you know how we talk about the religious divide between, you know, those dreadful Catholic Irish and, you know, the rest of the good Protestant establishment, Church of England, Church in Australia, in the early colony. Here, John Sullivan's application is signed none less than the Reverend Samuel Marsden, the top Church of England boyo in the colony, and John Joseph Terry, the top Catholic priest in the colony at the time. So, and Greg Blaxland, who of Across the Blue Mountains fame, who was also a JP. So These mere convicts were known to the top boys in the colony as well, if only in passing. Maybe he went to church at one or other of these. You know, we're not quite sure why he knows them or lives in that area. But it really puts paid to that whole religious divide idea, and I think it's why Australians are, in the main, fairly racially and religiously tolerant. Now, some of you all leap up and say, no, they're not, I've had a terrible time. But in the main, we're either reasonably tolerant or we're totally apathetic and we don't give a monkeys. The other thing these forms have got is on the second page of it, there's John Sullivan on the Marrow in 1827, sentenced 7 years. Wife's maiden name, Ellen Reedy. This is a convict who comes, whose wife you may never know her maiden name except from this form. And where is she? She's in County Kerry. And where in County Kerry? She's in Tralee. But she's not just in Tralee, she's at Roland Edgar's. So, you know, not only the dot on the map, but the house in which she's living and working. And her children, she's got one son, Timothy, who's five. And then the people in the local area who can identify her can say, yeah, that's definitely Mary Sullivan, whose husband was transported. So you've got local history on the ground in Ireland. They're absolutely fabulous. And then when they arrive, this is a group of convicts' wives who arrived on the Sir Joseph Banks. The vessel's the wife's name. So the top, Jane O'Brien, she's got five children with her. Her husband's Thomas, who came on the Isabella. And he is a stone sitter and holds his TL, his ticket of leave, in Sydney. Lovely material about your free and convict ancestor combined here. The dispatches went back, then summarise, that were sent back to London and then on to England, on to perhaps John Barnard in Cork or some guy in Scotland or Lynch in Tipperary, that summarises that material. So you've got William Burbridge, who came on the Elizabeth, his wife's Frances, and the details about her and who recommends her. So that goes back so that they can then try and find this person, in that case in Worcestershire or in the next one in Dulla or in Cork. Interestingly, that third one there the recommendation is H.B. Hayes, who's Henry Brown Hayes, who himself later happens to come on a convict ship as a convict. So I talked very briefly about the female immigration scheme and the books that Liz Rushen and I have been working on. That's just the cover of the one that is the overview of the two pilot ships. The Red Rover sailed out of Cork with Irish girls to Sydney, and the Princess Royal sailed out of England to Tasmania, and it was to test run how this scheme would work. 2,703 weren't on just those two ships, but on the whole scheme in that period, 32 to 36. The bounty scheme I vaguely mentioned before was to bring tradesmen, mechanics. They had to have character references, proof of age, and the settler who wanted workers paid the immigrants' passage or part thereof. And on arrival, they were examined by a board, and if the board was satisfied with the immigrant, then they were issued a certificate. And the sponsor could then claim back his money from the government land fund, and the agents like Barnard were involved. So in that period, and again, this costing changes slightly over time, but roughly £30 for a man and wife under 30 years, 15 for each single female aged between 15 and 30, with the approval of the settler or the agent, and under the protection of a married couple, often their parents, but sometimes other approved, marry a young married couple who had no children of their own. And they had to stay with the family or somewhere safe until they were provided for. £10 for each unmarried male between 18 and 30, and roughly equal numbers of males and females, so they didn't want to get the balance of the sexes skew with. and £5 for a child aged over 1 year. Now, under that scheme, because of some disaster they'd had on previous voyages, like the Lady McNaughton in 1837 had a lot of young children on board. It had 414 people on board, and 77 died either on the voyage or in quarantine at North Head in Sydney after the voyage, because there were so many little children on board, and they died from things like typhoid, measles, that spread rapidly through the population because of the small children on board. Most of the deaths were either young children or their mothers. So it was that period that they changed the regulations so you couldn't bring too many children under a certain age. So under this bounty scheme that happened a bit later, some of the children of bounty immigrants were left behind in Ireland. So they then brought in another scheme later in the period to bring the children of bounty immigrants. So it's the children of bounty immigrants that were then sometimes palled up with newly young married couples so that they could then too come out and join their families. So that's what I mean about there's a lot of kind of little schemes that happen throughout the whole 19th century. So the problems with the bounty scheme, and I'm just using the bounty scheme of any assisted immigration scheme, it may well even be the same today, was that settlers complained that not all the immigrants knew the trade that they claimed. So they might have said they were good at ploughing and they had no idea how to hitch up a plough to a horse, that kind of a thing, and you couldn't prove it once they were at the dock. So not many settlers had the money to pay the agents in the UK and Ireland or to act for them. The checks on the system were minimal, and the ship owners sometimes adjusted the arrangements. And the agents in Ireland and England were criticised for creating false impressions of a wonderful life in New South Wales. So they scrapped it. Records for the bounty scheme. Now, where I give you estate records of New South Wales reel, most of these fairly commonly available records were part of the old genealogical research kit. I'm now quite not sure they've changed the name of that. It's the material that's microfilmed from State Records of New South Wales and is available to you guys in the National Library and maybe also at Hacksog, Barbara, some of it. There's a great CD-ROM done by Marge Knight, who none of us seem to know who she is, but she did a fabulous job on this, that's got the bounty immigrants indexed, and that was published by Macbeth Services. And that's kind of scanned and available on State Records website now. They've got quite a lot of material that's up there, but most of it is indexes. And you must look at either the microfilm material of the full record or put it down on your little list to do when you go to Sydney or to Queensland or to New Zealand or wherever you need to go to look at the original stuff. And the Colonial Secretary's records were indexed by Joan Rees, who was a great friend of me personally and genealogy in general, who died a couple of years ago. Joan went every Monday to State Records and indexed the Colonial Secretary's records. State Records did a bicentennial project, 1788 to 1825. It's available on their website, also on Fish around the tracks. But Joan indexed from 1826 to 1896, 95, 96. And it's available, the index, on microfiche, and it is well worth looking at. The only thing I would criticise it for, and she agreed with that, but it's what she called it in the beginning and couldn't then change its name, is it's called Convicts and Others. So you might think, I haven't got a convict, I'm not looking at this index. She read through the page of every single letter and pulled out Mary Murphy per Red Rover and gave you the reference numbers in State Records for it. Check before you head to Sydney to look at those original records, whether they're microfilmed, and you can look at them here or in Wellington or wherever. You don't want to have to go somewhere when you could stay home. You want to use your time when you go there for things you can't look at home. I remember a story when I was doing my PhD A girl had got a grant from the university that she was at to go to Ireland to look at material that was here in the National Library on microfilm. I rest my case. So there's also the government scheme that runs from 1838 to 41-2, selected by agents. Governor Burke, Governor Richard Burke, sent three agents, Alec Osborne, who settled with his family and brothers in the Shoalhaven district. He was an Ulsterman, but he brought out a lot of Irish people, and they settled in those areas, not just Ulstermen. He went to Omagh, Tyrone, as an agent. So there's quite a pocket of immigrants from that area in Ireland that come in this period, and of course Barnard in Cork. From 1848 onwards, the Colonial Land Immigration Commissioners and the remittance regulations took over, and because it was so organised, there are a lot of material. There is a lot of material available, and it was organised and supervised and therefore generated documents. Those of you who haven't been to Sydney to see the famine orphan monument at Hyde Park Barracks, this is the side wall of Hyde Park Barracks. You can just glimpse the red brick building behind it, which is the wall of the barracks itself, where the girls were housed. This wall, I don't know whether Heritage would allow it these days. This section of the wall was, to all intents and purposes, removed and rotated on its axis. And in the panels are the artistically the name of the famine orphan girls. Not all of them are listed there. And no, if you've got a girl and there's not a name listed there, you can't have her listed there. It's an artistic installment. These girls' names are representative of all the famine orphan girls that came out of the workhouses. But they're also representative of all of our Irish immigrants that came. And more importantly, these days, this committee has got an outreach program that donates money towards a prize for a girl, and we've left it just a girl. I know it's sexist, but, you know, a girl at Macquarie University who has written an honours essay or thesis about some aspect of poverty, immigration, refugee or destitution. So it's fairly broad. And it's not a lot of money, but it's just an encouragement to a student. And there's also two schemes, one at the University of Western Sydney, where a certain amount of money, $20,000 in fact, was donated to start a bursary, ultimately a scholarship, to sustain a student at that university, a girl who came to Australia either as a refugee herself or with a family who were refugees. And then the third scheme is at Mamre in St Mary's, which is not far from the Kingswood Repository, which is currently run by the Sisters of Mercy and has a lot of Sudanese refugee women and children particularly, but families, and where they're teaching these women and families to self-sustain. And so there's some money that goes into that. Any donations you may make through that website, even up to $2, go straight to that fund and they're tax deductible. So the idea of that is to keep this psyche of the famine orphan girls that come out of Ireland in 1848 to 50 as a reminder that they may have been some of the first immigrants that fled their home because of economic persecution or famine or destitution or religious persecution. So I just think it's a great way to keep the memory of those alive and to keep it sustained into the future. The Donegal Relief Scheme brought Irish immigrants out of northwest Donegal. At that stage, one of the most marginal areas in Europe on the coastal fringe. The main areas affected were Gweedore and Clochaneely, some of the first townlands I ever learnt to say properly, and the village of Derryvay on the northwestern shore of Garden Lough. It was basically, in summary, I mean, all these things are much more complicated than you can say in a quick lecture. I could probably talk about this alone for an hour. It was basically caused by a landlord system where the payment of rents combined with tiny plots of land, which generation after generation was split down the families, so that tenants could neither eke a living out of or pay their rent. So many were evicted as the landlords tried to rejoin their properties back to make them viable. And of course, in the 1850s, most were Gaelic speaking, and even today, it's an Irish speaking Gaeltacht area of Ireland. So there are a few main ships to New South Wales in 1859. Some of you may have immigrants on that brought these Donegal immigrants, the Sapphire, the Lady Alma Bruce, the Caribou, the Nile, and the Abyssinian were some of the major ships that brought immigrants at that period. So for all immigration, and I'm talking New South Wales because we're talking early 19th century and it's basically New South Wales. So there's immigration agents lists, there's the immigration boards lists, there's entitlement certificates. All of these give you details about your Irish immigrants. There's immigration deposit ledgers when people put down a certain amount of money, like the remittance regulations. So John Brown might have put down some money to bring out Mary Murphy and her brothers and sisters. There's a ledger for that survives between 1856 and 1896 is the period of that. But the indexes were done by Pat Stemp and Aileen Trinder, as she was then. And that's the immigration deposit ledgers. Past keys, you might know these two girls as. They've been furiously indexing for a lot of years, and they've done some fabulous ways of getting us into this material. Ships papers survive for some ships in state records or in other places in England. Correspondence between the New South Wales Immigration Department from 1847 onwards. So the records of Colonial Land Immigration Commissioners from 1840 onwards. Various immigration-related records of the Colonial Office. The Colonial Office was in London. The records for that are housed at Kew in England. But for us in Australia, we are extremely fortunate. There's a microfilming project that started just post-World War II where they microfilm material relating to Australia that is sitting in England and, in some cases, in Ireland. And not just in Kew, but also in some of the county record offices. It's not terribly well indexed or organised. If you've got a period of time that you're looking at, the Australian Joint Copying Handbooks are available in the National Library for you to look at. And you can troll through and maybe find there might be some colonial office records in, say, 1840, which might be the period that your immigrants came. It is well worth you sitting there, having a day, just turning the microfilm reel through that period to look for them. It's absolutely brilliant. Unfortunately, it's now ceased. I spoke about the Irish being educated. This is a typical mid-19th century schoolhouse. It is in the west of Ireland, in Clare, just up the hill, out of Liscannor as you head up the cliffs of Moher. It's now a private house, so it's a little bit more tarted up than it may have been then, but it's very typical. On the left-hand side are the boys, on the right-hand side are the girls, and the teacher goes in the middle. Typical little schoolhouse. It's great. But they're all over Ireland still. Sometimes still in use, I think, Joan. Yeah. And so what I wanted to remind you is this read and write column, but I've already talked to you about that before. So this is a register for the National Schoolhouse on the Blasket Islands, way, way in the west of Ireland, next stop America almost, no longer permanently occupied. And it just shows you the children going in there in 1893, the child John Carney, age 7, Thomas Crohan, age 6, and a couple of other kids, and that they're going to school. Some of these still exist. Terry Eakin, who's a genealogist in Sydney, has got a big, strong affiliation with Ulster and has been collecting material on school records. And he does an e-newsletter, which you can pick up for free, whether you're a member or not, off the Society of Australian Genealogists website, just www.sag.org.au, and go to newsletters. It's called All Ireland Newsletter. And he's indexed each year. So you get 12 volumes, one for each month, and then at the end of the year you get an index. Well worth looking at what Terry's done on that. A few little extra hints. Look everywhere. Newspapers online. Any of us who live anywhere in Australia must have your National Library's reader's ticket so you can go online and look at newspapers online. You can look at 19th century newspapers online. A pay-to-use website, which if you have your National Library's reader's ticket, you don't have to pay. You can just go on there. It's a little bit like that horrible ad for Ancestry. You don't need to know what you're looking for. You just have to look. You do need to know what you're looking for. I'm not sure, just sitting here with an Irish friend in the front row who I'll introduce you to in a second, and our Kiwi mate up the back, whether you have to be an Australian resident. I don't think so. I think if you've got a National Library reader's ticket from Australia, and they're not really going to know whether you're going online from Wellington or Dublin. Yeah. And back just finally, I'll end up, before we do questions, with my Matthew Michael McGlynn, who I couldn't find. There he is at the bottom of an unassisted shipping list in 1879, coming on the City of London. And you say to me, how do you know M. McGlynn's him? Well, I didn't, until an index at the Public Record Office of Victoria, PRO Vic, indexed the passengers who are unassisted, in other words, who paid their own way, that came to Victoria from British, foreign and New Zealand ports between 1852 and 1923. This ship left Portsmouth, sailed to Adelaide, a few people got off, sailed to Melbourne, a few people got off. In Melbourne, they did a list of who was on board. And here he is here, Michael, M-I-C-H, guide L, McGlynn, a joiner, age 30. And in the final column of that, you can see all those people were heading to Sydney. It's the only place I would never have known from that and these other guys, Maguire, Silverwood, and Garman, who are there, who also here have their full names, who he was. So look everywhere. And a final where to look. You wouldn't expect one of your respectable Irish immigrant girls who come out of a workhouse or somewhere else in the middle of the 19th century to appear, that's not what I want yet, I'll do it at the end, in a jail register. I'll show you one. Think about the landscape from which they came. That's the Ring of Kerry from the air, reasonably recently. Every one of those little fields may well have been the one field where your ancestor farmed and lived before the famine. The landscape of Ireland changed radically because of deaths and immigration. And just keep in mind that the population pre-famine was about 8 million, they're estimated. It is still nothing back to that. Even with the Celtic Tiger, which is currently lulled a little bit, the population of the whole of Ireland, Ulster and Northern Ireland included, is still only around 5 million. So the landscape changed hugely. Use your maps pre- and post-famine. That shows you the marginal land in the west of Ireland. That's Connemara in the west of Galway. That little tiny remainder of a building may well be your ancestral home. The scars on the landscape are left from the lazy beds where they planted the potatoes in among the rocks. Every tiny piece of arable land grew potato as the subsistence crop. And that's why Ireland was so affected by the famine. The blight also was in Europe and England, but because Ireland was basically a subsistence, one crop country at the time, that's why it was so so affected. Again, that's simplistic. There were pockets that were not affected. Think about the house that your ancestor may have lived in. Was it something like this? The O'Brien's house at Lemina, a Lemina castle in Clare? Maybe. That's where you can track back your family history to, perhaps. Was it somewhere like that? Probably more plausible. Perhaps. That's Guido and Clocanealy. These are brilliant pictures from the National Library in Dublin that are online. That's why it's a bit fuzz, because it's kind of theft off the National Library's website. There's your family, but they're reasonably well clothed. They may be barefooted, but they're not in total tatters. Their house has got a roof, and indeed that house has got a window with glass in it. Or was it more just a hovel? In Australian terms, perhaps a bark hut, like the Aborigines used to have, some of them, just a bark shelter. But remembering the climate in Ireland is somewhat less warm than Australia, although I think in the west of Ireland in winter it may not have been as bitter as Canberra in winter. And I've never been as cold in winter ever in my life as Wellington, New Zealand. Or were they from somewhere like this? This is a quite substantial house again. Good roof, tied down roof, glass in the windows, substantial walls, probably relatively easy enough to warm with a fire in there and your cow and your pig to help warm it. So to end with the photographic jail books. These are indexed online, but they're unfortunately not indexed by anything except the name. But for those of us in genealogy, the name wave were well and good enough. But then you have to go and look at these records, state records, New South Wales, out at Kingswood. Here's Marion Blake in 1872 in jail. She's born in Dublin in 1843, and she's from comes on the ship the Champion of the Seas in 1862. She's a Protestant, she can read and write, and there she is, looking quite respectable, I thought. But she seems to have a rather swell in her belly there, I think, and indeed she's in there for prostitution. So the poor darling is probably very pregnant and has no other way of supporting herself by committing some form of crime which gets her into jail. And the other one, Mary Ann Young, is on the Thomas Arbuthnot, which doesn't actually have a sir in the real ship name, and she was a famine orphan girl that came in 1850. And by 1872, she is in jail, having committed manslaughter. So I'd just like to end there. Don't feel you have to run away. I know the time is ticking by, but I'm quite happy to answer questions. And on Monday evening, a close friend of mine, Joan Kavanagh, from Ireland, arrived in Sydney, and I bundled her into the car this morning. In fact, she got me awake, and we came down to be involved in this conference and for me to do this lecture today. But Joan is quite happy to help answer questions. She spent, as she said, for her sins, some time in the Wicklow jail, which was indeed the headquarters of the Heritage Centre in County Wicklow. So she knows her genealogy well. So I'll finish here. If some of you have to leave, do so, but we're quite happy to answer questions. And don't forget to use your ticket to go and see the Not Just Ned exhibition. And please come and join us at the conference Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Thanks.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.